Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Errol Lewis of The Daily News, in for Brian Larry. You're listening to WNYC. We've been talking with Israel's withdrawal from the Gaza Strip with the Israeli Council General. And now for a Palestinian perspective. Much of the media has focused on the discord between pro- and anti-withdrawal Jews, but when the settlements have been bulldozed and the Israeli army is gone from Gaza, Palestinians will be left with a dusty strip of land along the Mediterranean Sea, a lot of poverty in that destitute strip, and it's one of the most densely populated places on Earth. It's been said to be a breeding ground for terrorism. Joining me now to talk about the future of Gaza is Nubar Hovsepian. He's a professor of political science and international studies at Chapman University in Orange City, California. He's Palestinian by birth, and he joins us now from Seattle. Professor Hovsepian, welcome back to WNYC.
Yes, I'm actually Armenian-born in Cairo, but that's minor details.
Okay. Let me start with the last question I asked to the Israeli Consul General. What happens after Israel leaves Gaza? What will the place look like in a week or a month or a year from now?
Well, it's not going to look too different than it is right now. It is the highest concentration of poverty. It's one of the densest places in terms of number of people per square kilometer. It is a place that economically is strangulated by the Israeli economy. It has no right to have its goods shipped in or out. It does not control its borders. It has no control over its airspace, and therefore its ability to trade on the international market, the free market that our president touts so much, is something that Palestinians are not are denied.
That's the situation now. Are there plans to change it so that there would be more economic growth in the territory?
Well, those conditions will continue after the Israeli withdrawal. After all, the ingress and egress from the Gaza Strip will be still controlled by Israel. The border with Egypt is still controlled by Israel. The border on the sea, the coast, is still controlled by Israel. Palestinians have no right to ship things by sea out or by land out. So what happens to any attempt to have to transform any economic advantage that might have to export things to the European market is still highly controlled by Israel, even though Israeli troops will have left the area.
When you say controlled, do you mean in a security sense or a taxation sense? I'm not clear on what you mean.
Controlled physically. Nothing goes in, nothing goes out.
Will residents of Gaza themselves be allowed to enter Israel, where many of them work?
Well, no. In the past few years, no, for security reasons and for many other reasons. But will they be allowed to work? That depends on bilateral relations between Israel and the Palestinian authority. Now, there are certain things that Palestinians can do if they're allowed to import and export the needs that they have. They have plenty of labor power. They just don't have the materials and the resources necessary to develop the area. It has to have an ability to deal with the outside world. It has to deal with the Arab world. It has to deal with the European world. So far, the economic relationship, as Sarah Roy of Harvard University has put it in her wonderful book on the Gaza Strip, it is a policy of de-development that has disabled the Gaza Strip from developing.
What kind of aid do you think might be made available when the withdrawal takes place? And as we heard in the previous segment, there's a new interest in European governments and other governments around the world in helping the peace process go forward.
Well, indeed, the Europeans have obviously played a major role, and particularly the Scandinavian countries, Norway, and also Italy have played a major role in the financing of Palestinian development projects. I suspect that will continue via the EU and individually through bilateral relations between individual European countries. So they have been on the ground for a long time trying to do that. Unfortunately, the past few years, most of the development aid has gone to try to prevent the population from falling below the poverty line. It used to be $1 a day defined as poverty. Now, according to the World Bank, it's 2.1. About 40 to 50% of the Palestinian population in the Gaza Strip was below the poverty line the last few years. So the economic support that went in was simply to prevent people from falling further down. That is crisis management rather than development. Now we hope that development can take place, that national policies can be in place to develop and not simply to maintain the absence of poverty.
I'm Errol Lewis of the Daily News, in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We're talking with Nubar Hovsepian, professor of political science at Chapman University in Orange City, California. I'd like to ask a question about the politics within the Gaza Strip. The Palestinian Authority, which is dominated by the Fatah faction of the PLO, is normally seen as the partner, but there's a really powerful rival in Gaza, which is Hamas. Is there a power struggle underway?
Well, yes and no. I mean, we can call it a power struggle, or we can call it that there are two or three basic constituencies within the Gaza Strip. There is the secular forces, and the secular forces could be the Fatah movement and other smaller organizations within the PLO structure historically. Then you have the Islamic movement, predominantly Hamas, but other smaller groups as well. So there is a battle right now for the hearts and minds of Palestinians. Is it the secular route or is it the Islamic route? Well, unfortunately, in the last decade or so across the Middle East, secular politics has been defeated. President Bush has helped create a theocratic state in Iraq, which is not very, doesn't help us very much in the Gaza Strip either. So those who are animated by Islam and by religion are the ones who are offering people non-corrupt practices. The battle will continue among Palestinians to save their polity. Right now it is a compromised polity. It is a divided polity, but that's fine. Divided polities do not necessarily lead to conflict. They need to healthy competition, which is what I'm hoping for.
By non-corrupt practices, are you talking about social service programs and feeding programs, that sort of thing?
Yes, the Islamic movement has, by and large, actually, I mean, if you think of a state as one that allocates resources to its population through social welfare policies. I know the words social welfare don't sound very good in America today, but generally that's what the state does, whether it's the American state under Bush or any other state. Well, the Islamic movement in the Gaza Strip has been playing a larger role in allocating resources, especially services to people, than the state, because the state's ability to function has been rather weakened in the last decade or so.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, Professor Hovsepian, but I was always under the impression that among Palestinians, in that corner of the Arab world, there was a very strong secular movement, that there were a lot of engineers and a lot of advanced scientists and a lot of modern thinking as far as the role of women. Is that in retreat? Is that under attack right now?
No, I didn't say it doesn't exist. On the contrary, as I put it, was that there are two poles to Palestinian politics, a secular and a religiously inspired movement. They are now vying for the hearts and minds of Palestinians. The secular thrust of Palestinian politics remains, probably less so in the Gaza Strip than in the West Bank, but the two are there. The two are there. They're competing for the hearts and minds of people. Will the Palestinian Authority be able to gain the trust of Palestinians? Will the Palestinian Authority be empowered to do things? Remember, the Palestinian Authority in 1993-94, the beginning of the Oslo process, was respected by people because there was hope. There was hope for economic development, so forth and so on. But when that hope dissipated, then the distrust of the Palestinian Authority increased correspondingly. So I would say increase the ability to develop and to create jobs and to eliminate misery, then the secular forces have as good a chance, if not better, of being dominant in Palestinian politics.
Speaking of Palestinian politics, Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian leader, has set a date for municipal elections for next January. Do you see this fight being played out in those elections?
Sure, sure. You know, I'm sure the Islamic forces And in fact, I think this is a very healthy sort of thing, because part of politics, that is, you have a movement, Palestinian movement, that was, for a variety of reasons, can be captured as a resistance movement of some sort or another. It has to make the transition into the state-building process. It's very tough to make the transition towards a state-building political movement when your country is occupied still. But nevertheless, this dual thing is happening simultaneously. Yes, there will be competition. Islamic forces will win some seats, and they will be then accountable to the public to deliver the goods. And secular forces will win other seats, and they will have to debate it out in the various municipal councils, and ultimately leading to the Palestinian Legislative Council, which is the parliament in lieu of a full parliament.
Do you expect Hamas to participate in the elections?
I suspect they will. I mean, I suspect they will. Some might not participate, but they did participate in the municipal elections in the West Bank and in the student elections and in the civil society organizations elections. So I suspect they will continue to participate because they want to be able to, they do not want to be excluded from the Palestinian polity. And remember, the more you exclude people, the more likely you have the reasons for an internal crisis. You have to be able to resolve it by having an inclusive polity. This is the lesson that we learned from Mr. Mandela in South Africa, who was considered by his opponents as a terrorist. He was able to bring together all of the parties together to move on and to create a new polity. That's what is needed, an inclusive rather than an exclusive polity.
I'm Errol Lewis of the Daily News, in for Brian Lehrer. You're listening to WNYC. We've been talking about Israel's withdrawal from the Gaza Strip from a Palestinian perspective with my guest, Nubar Hovsepian, a professor of political science at Chapman University. Mr. Hovsepian, how much do Palestinians trust Ariel Sharon today? He's considered by many a war criminal, at least by some factions in the Palestinian movement, for his activities with the Israeli army in South Lebanon. But now we have him facing down the most hardline people in his own country and pushing for a withdrawal, which for many is near treason. Is he a partner for peace at this point?
Well, I mean, that he is a war criminal is something that should be determined by a court of law. You know, I think he is, and I think there's a prima facie evidence to prove that case, especially for his collaboration with the massacre of Palestinians in the refugee camps of Sabra and Shatila in 1982 under Israeli watch when the Falangists and the Lebanese forces did it. Do they trust him? I don't think so. They don't trust him. And second, they don't trust him for a very important reason. That is, the question that is being raised in Palestinian circles and among Israeli critics. For example, a few weeks ago, we had a guest speaker, Avram Borg, the former minister, the former speaker of the Knesset, and he was against the Gaza withdrawal for the following reason. He said, and I think Palestinians share this viewpoint, that the Israelis will claim that the amount of sacrifice required to withdraw from Gaza will occasion the postponement of any withdrawal from the West Bank for another 10 to 20 years, which will therefore pave the road for further conflict. No, they don't trust him because they don't believe he wants to withdraw from the West Bank.
Well, let's say that that's true. What about this overall demographic question, which the ambassador made reference to, the fact that, and especially on the West Bank, that if Israel continues to remain on the West Bank, the faster rate of growth in the Palestinian population will actually make it a non-Jewish state in the next, I think, 25 to 30 years.
Well, I think the demographic question is an important question, which also raises then another question. Given that, will Israel, as Tony Judd wonderfully put it in the New York Review of Books about a year and a half ago, the alternative, will Israel want to remain a Jewish and democratic state, or a Jewish and an authoritarian state ruling over other people? I think that those are the stark choices that the Israeli polity will have to make. They're so intertwined. The Israeli future and the Palestinian future are not separable. They cannot be separated. But the question is, will the Palestinians of the West Bank be incorporated in the Israeli polity, or would they continue to be viewed as the equivalent of Bantustans to be ruled by a foreign rule? And what will that do to the Israeli body politic? I think all of those questions will come to the fore. And I think ultimately the issue will have to be, will the U.S. pressure the continuation of the peace process, whatever that means, towards its proper conclusion, which is the establishment of a Palestinian state, to give Palestinians a stake in building something rather than in defending themselves and in being dispossessed. Dispossessed don't have a stake. Those who have a state are not dispossessed, and they need, therefore, to engage in the process of state building and nation building. Right now, they don't have that.
One of the things I was surprised by when I did visit Israel was the extent, when talking with ministers, of the economic drain on Israel of the current situation, of people being yanked out for military service weeks and months at a time, very high rates of unemployment, sky-high rates of inflation. Do you see this as one of the factors that could help lead to a better resolution in Gaza and elsewhere?
Yes, I actually hope so. That is, Israel is paying a price, and so of course the Palestinians paying an enormous price. Any economic development that they have attempted has been destroyed. That is, you always go back to square zero to start all over again, and it becomes tiring. Yes, that is a factor. It drains the Israeli economy. It is draining and sapping the energies of Palestinians. That is not a formula for moving a peace process forward. So unless a political decision has to be made, you've identified the economic factor as a contextual issue, but a decision has to be made that is political, that is a question of political will. Can we make a decision? Mr. Sharon has made a decision to move, and he will succeed because the state is a powerful organization that can ultimately bring to its force to bear, its influence to bear on even recalcitrant parts of the population. He will have to make that same decision vis-a-vis the West Bank, or what the ambassador said of the demographic question and other questions will make it almost impossible to separate Palestinian from Israeli, and then you have a completely different set of considerations to talk about.
Well, going in the other direction, one of the political facts on the ground is the barrier on the West Bank, which seems, from the Israeli perspective, to have stopped a lot of the terror attacks. Is that going to be one of the factors that also has to be dealt with?
Yes, of course. But remember, you know, it's like new facts almost shift the discussion from the pre-existing facts. Actually, I think the worst part, I mean, let's say that for the Israeli standards, for argument's sake, although I still consider it not a salutary development, let's say for argument's sake that this wall has been good for Israel. But remember, what is worse for Palestinians is not just a wall. It's the existence of settlements. It's the fact that the Israeli settlements consume 60% of the water, of the Palestinian water from Palestinian aquifers in the West Bank. In other words, the resources that enable development are being taken by a small percentage of the population. And the existence of those settlements are preventing the presence of a geographic contiguity, as a reporter for Time magazine a few years ago put it. The West Bank resembles Swiss cheese. The Israelis have the cheese and the Palestinians have the whole. As long as that situation exists, the settlements, that's the key issue, if I might say, Mr. Lewis, and not the wall. The wall is an additive, but not the primary.
I know that you've got contacts with people in the Palestinian areas. What's the general sentiment over there? Is there a sense of optimism about the withdrawal from Gaza?
No. I think there's actually a sense of fear. There's a sense of fear that the withdrawal from Gaza means the non-withdrawal from the West Bank.
Okay. We're going to leave it right there.
And I'd like to
thank you for joining me, Professor Nubar Hovsepian of Chapman University in Orange City, California. Best of luck to you in these troubled times.
Thank you, sir.
We'll be right back.